This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Today we're going to talk about Germany and Russia. Russia is creating some real problems for Europe. Vladimir Putin is chewing away at territory on Europe's eastern frontier. He's getting involved in Syria, taking on an increased role in the Middle East. He's threatening to use nuclear weapons. These things make Europeans really nervous. And now it looks like Russia is meddling in German politics. He's pushing propaganda about the migrant crisis that undermines Chancellor Angela Merkel. He's hosting visits from politicians in Bavaria that also make Germany's chancellor look weak. And that last item has interesting historical implications because it seems consistent with a historical trend of cooperation of convenience between these two great powers, Germany and Russia, that tends to portend war. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about this precarious and dangerous relationship between Germany and Russia. Crises and political struggles in Germany have many people saying that Chancellor Merkel needs to go, that it's time for new leadership. And we're going to talk with Trumpet writer Brad McDonald about one man that some people are really hopeful will step into that role within Germany. That is Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg. In our third segment, we're going to cover something completely different. Do you find that your mental attention span is shrinking? Do you find it difficult to focus on mentally challenging activity? KPCG just might be able to help you. We have a new program. It's going to begin airing on this radio station starting next Monday, March 7th. It's called Just the Best Literature. It aims to stimulate your mind and help you reclaim your brain processing power. It's going to be presented by Trumpet writer Dennis Leap. We're going to talk with him about this program, what he hopes to accomplish, and why you really ought to tune into it. We're going to conclude the show today with a few words about kicking your kids outdoors. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. In last week's Week in Review program, we talked about the propaganda campaign it looks like Russia is waging against Europe, a campaign to smear Angela Merkel's leadership in Germany, especially the way that she's handled the Muslim refugee crisis. But there is an interesting counter trend. The leadership in Russia seems to be reaching out to some German leaders, particularly from the state of Bavaria, including Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury made some recent comments on this subject that could well become a feature article in the next Trumpet print edition. And to talk about this, we have Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques. Hello, Jeremiah.
Hello there.
So let's just start by talking about these headlines that we're seeing recently that show this developing relationship between Vladimir Putin and these German politicians.
Sure. Yeah, I think probably the most salient of these headlines was the one that was about this February 4th visit by Mr. Horst Seehofer, who is the current Prime Minister President of Bavaria, to Moscow to meet with President Putin. Ahead of this visit, Germany's Die Welt said, "This meeting is not in Merkel's interests." And really, I think that's kind of an understatement if you consider the dynamics happening there between Russia and the Bavarian leadership. It really seems like this meeting and another meeting that will probably soon follow it between Putin and Seehofer, along with zu Guttenberg this next time, it seems like these are designed to show Germans that Putin would rather deal with these Bavarian leaders, these men who seem willing to deal with him more on his own terms than he would with Merkel. And so you mentioned that propaganda campaign that the Russian media is waging in Germany. It seems like that's designed to really weaken Merkel's leadership at the same time as Putin is reaching out to these other leaders who seem a little more just willing to make some kind of a pact with him or a series of agreements that would give him more of the kind of power that he wants.
So these are really two sides of the same strategy. That if we're reading this correctly and this propaganda campaign that we've been talking about is actually happening to the degree that we suggest or that certain headlines suggest. This is actually more evidence of Russian meddling in German politics.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I'd like to just read a short quote from this Die Welt article. This was published on February 2nd. It says, Seehofer is Merkel's most dangerous critic. For months, he has been bombarding the chancellor with ultimatums. He finds the chancellor's refugee policy to be utterly flawed, not just in the details, but fundamentally. He may be flying to meet Putin as the state premier of Bavaria, but he will be received in Moscow as a representative of one of Germany's three governing parties. So it really seems like Putin views the Bavarian leadership as something maybe a little more robust than a lot of other analysts and onlookers would. Most of the world would say, you know, Germany is Merkel. That's the leadership. But Putin sees things a little bit differently. He views Seehofer and his affiliates, such as zu Gutenberg and even Stoiber to an extent, as a very legitimate aspect of the German leadership.
The relationship between Russia and Europe, especially Russia and Germany, this is something that we've focused a lot of attention on over the years. And there's a really important historical reason for that. Could you just talk for a bit about why political cooperation between Moscow and Berlin is something that should really be of concern to us?
Sure. Yeah, students of history will remember that back on August 21st of 1939, the government of Nazi Germany and the government of the Soviet Union agreed to conclude what they called a pact of non-aggression with each other. And history revealed that title to be kind of a euphemism. 2 days later, the infamous Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact was official, and some people call that the Hitler-Stalin Pact. And that pact was a promise of non-belligerence or non-aggression by either party toward the other one. So Germany was not allowed to attack the USSR and vice versa. And just a week after it was signed, Germany invaded Poland, which officially ignited World War II. So that history is really imperative to remember. And then one thing that happened just in November of 2014 was that Russian President Vladimir Putin shocked the world by saying nothing was wrong with the Soviet Union signing that pact with Adolf Hitler. I'll just read a quote what he said. Serious research must show that those were the foreign policy methods then. The Soviet Union signed a non-aggression treaty with Germany. People say, ah, that's bad. But what's bad about that if the Soviet Union didn't want to fight? What's bad about it? That's Putin's quote. But this Hitler-Stalin pact was not a real declaration of pacifism. And Putin's historic revisionism won't make it so. Putin actually knows full well that Molotov-Ribbentrop pact or the Hitler-Stalin pact included secret protocols that divided up Poland, Romania, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, and Finland into spheres of influence for Germany and the Soviets. Up until 1989, that was secret, and it was something that the Russians denied. But in 1989, the Russians acknowledged that. They said, yes, there were these secret protocols that divided up all of these Eastern European countries into spheres of influence. And as a direct result of the protection from each other granted by that pact, both the Soviets and the Nazis ravaged Poland. The USSR captured and executed more than 20,000 Poles in the 1940 Katyn massacre. And then the Germans started a campaign that ended up slaughtering around 3 million Polish Jews. So Putin's saying, those were just the foreign policy methods at that time. There was nothing wrong with Russia or with the Soviet Union signing that pact. But I really think that the fact that Putin is endorsing that pact now and just sort of trying to whitewash that history, it should sober news watchers.
So really, you have to look at this as Germany and Russia viewing each other as the main potential threat that would prevent them from being able to realize their ambitions elsewhere, that Germany felt like we have to make sure that we kind of neutralize the potential threat from the Soviet Union so that we can go about our business of taking over Europe and going on from there. And Russia had a similar kind of way of thinking, that basically they want to to neutralize the potential threat to Germany from Germany to the Soviet Union. So for that kind of agreement, it really is a precursor to war. It's a naked attempt to shore up those elements that could prevent them from realizing those wider ambitions.
Yes, that's right. You mentioned Mr. Gerald Fleury's statements that he made in that message about this. I'll just read a quote from that. He said, "Just a week after it was signed, Germany invaded Poland, officially igniting World War II. This history is imperative to remember because Germany and Russia are now getting cozy again. That is an indication that war is coming. Because these two powers do not love each other. This is a marriage of convenience, and that's all."
Right. So looking at this in modern terms, already we see Russia having a pretty aggressive policy in a lot of different areas within Eastern Europe. And Putin has been very canny in the way that he's undertaken these ventures. We've even talked about the possibility that there's already been some collusion and some agreement between Moscow and Berlin, that basically Berlin has acknowledged Russia's right to undertake some of these things. Particularly, I think it was before they invaded Crimea, we were looking at evidence that basically Germany had signed off on Russia doing that before it took place. So you already see evidence of some similar type of cooperation taking place today. And now, added to that, we're kind of viewing this shuttling back and forth between German politicians and Russian politicians and Bavarian leaders visiting Moscow in that context, and the possibility of Putin trying to shore up his relationship with Germany and what that might indicate as to Russia's ambitions in the coming months.
Yeah, that's right. I think that now that we see, we've seen the results of some of these behind-the-scenes agreements between Russia and Germany in the recent future, we've seen that, you know, what can happen when Germany gives its tacit agreement to things like the Georgia invasion back in 2008 or the Crimean annexation in 2014. And it's really sobering to now suddenly see this spate of visits between the CSU leadership there in Bavaria and Putin once again. It just makes you think, what are they discussing behind these meetings? Very little is revealed about the content, if anything, of the meetings. But just the fact that they're happening is raising a lot of eyebrows in the intelligence community.
And kind of in the background of this whole development, you really have to look at it in terms of German fear of just how powerful Russia may become, even though to this point, say, they've signed off on some of these things, or it appears that they may have, and that they're visiting Moscow and that type of thing. It seems like the reality is that they're doing that because they have to under the circumstances. But we've talked about just how much Russia's aggression could contribute to Europe taking on more power and really trying to get its act together and to unify, to increase its military capacity. We've talked recently about how they wanted to step up their use of nuclear weapons and increase the capability of their nuclear arsenal because of Russia's nuclear saber rattling. You know, even if it looks like there's agreement in the short term, really you have to view Germany's activities in light of Russia's activities as the precursor to something far more, like them really growing in a lot of power, or really feeling like this could catalyze, this has to be a catalyst to increased unification and power for Europe.
I think that's an excellent point. This fear among Europeans of the resurgence of Russia is serving to dismantle a lot of the barriers that have stood in the way of European unity. And especially in Eastern Europe, you have more and more of the leadership there just saying, "Germany, help us. We're willing to throw our support totally behind you if you rise up so that we can present a unified front against this growing threat there in the East coming from Russia." And I did want to share one more quote from Mr. Fleury's statements here. He just looked forward a little bit about what the next agreement could possibly be about. He said, We can't know all that's going on in Germany or Russia, but we do know that Germany will need some kind of a pact, such as the old Hitler-Stalin agreement, before they unleash their military power on the King of the South or the Iran-led radical extremists. And then he goes on, after all, with the Syrian conflict, Russia is now embedded firmly in the Middle East. If Germany wanted to strike Iran, they would need to first clear it with the Kremlin. And Russia would probably think, well, if Germany goes in there, they're going to really hurt themselves, and that'll boost Russia's power relative to Europe, so let them go. Or something along those lines. So I thought that was a really interesting analysis. Just a lot of this might be about the Middle East. And then in September, Seehofer said the Syrian situation could not be stabilized without Europe working with Putin. And then in Gutenberg's recent article that he wrote for the CSIS, he made similar statements, just saying the West needs to cooperate with Russia. And that actually reversed Gutenberg's previous stance on Russia. Before, he was trying to ignore them, but now it really seems like he's acknowledged that it's a necessary fact, as unpleasant as it may be, that Europe needs to cooperate in order to bring some stability to the Middle East there.
Pretty remarkable how much influence and power Russia has amassed under Putin in recent years, and particularly with this situation in Syria, how it's kind of gotten this foothold into the Middle East, which has to alarm Germany that much more. This is a really interesting situation to watch unfold, and the relationship between these two countries really something that we need to keep our eye on. We've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about the German-Russian relationship and where this could take us in the months and the years ahead. Thanks for your time and for your insights.
Great to be here.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Germany is in a really precarious position right now. It's the strongest nation in the EU, but it's trying to manage multiple serious crises, economic problems in nations all over the Eurozone, an intense migrant crisis. As many as 1.5 million Middle Eastern migrants flooded the country last year, several threats around the world, not the least of which is an ascendant Russia. Chancellor Angela Merkel, who has enjoyed tremendous popularity over the years, she is now facing a real backlash among the German people who are not happy with her, especially the way that she's handled the migrant situation. There's a real sense that new leadership is needed in order to address these problems and to lead Germany and Europe forward. The Trumpet has been anticipating this moment for decades. We've drawn our readers' attention to biblical prophecies of a strong man rising up in Germany to answer the call. Herbert W. Armstrong talked about this for decades before us. And one individual we've kept our eyes on for some years as a candidate to step into this position is Karl Theodor zu Gutenberg. This is an impressive man, an aristocratic man. He was a defense minister in Germany at one time. He's been out of politics for the past 5 years. But there are more and more people calling on him to come back and to get back into politics. I have trumpet writer Brad McDonald here to talk about some of this man's recent activities. And we have him online here via Skype from our office in Britain. Hello, Brad.
Good morning.
So you drew our attention here last week to this interview that Gutenberg did with the Financial Times. Why don't we just start by talking about that? And you were particularly impressed with just the stature of the individual from the Financial Times who was wanted to spend time with Gutenberg.
That's right. This was the first time that I've seen a Western journalist of this renown, a Western journalist this prominent, pay this much attention to zu Gutenberg and to hint at a comeback.
So this is the Financial Times' chief foreign affairs commentator, Gideon Rachman. What can you tell us about him?
Well, I mean, obviously, I don't know him too personally, but he's one of the most prominent journalists here in Europe. He's writing, obviously, for one of the most prominent newspapers, not just here in Europe, but the Financial Times is read the world over. you know, when I think of Western journalists or journalists living and operating out of Europe and reporting on European events, Gideon Ruckman is probably the first name that comes to mind for me. So the fact that he would sit down, or he would choose to call Zu Gutenberg and arrange to sit down and interview him, that's just interesting. It makes you wonder what does Ruckman see in Zu Gutenberg? And then if you read the article, he clearly hints at and suggests that Zu Gutenberg may be making a comeback.
So let's talk about this. They sat down to a meal, and I mean, this is a pretty lengthy feature piece with quite a bit of information about the conversation that the two of them had. What were the points that stood out to you from it?
Well, the second paragraph stood out to me. It says, ever since Zu Gutenberg stepped down, there has been speculation about his return to German politics. And that's true, and we've reported on that. You know, a number of CSU politicians in Germany have hinted at Zu Gutenberg making a return. From time to time, the German media and German journalists have hinted at Zu Gutenberg making a return. But here's Ruckman in the Financial Times now picking up this story. But he continues in this article, now with Chancellor Merkel in deep political trouble over Germany's refugee crisis, might this be the time for him to resurrect his political career? As political pundits run through the rather thin list of possible leaders in a post-Merkel era, some eyes have begun to stray over the Atlantic to the Baron across the water. And it seems like Gideon Ruckman's eyes are among that group.
Right. The fact that Gutenberg has been out of German politics for some time, he's been living in the United States for some time and kind of making the rounds at international conferences and stepping into the press from time to time with interview situations. But so they're saying we need to get this guy back into Germany.
Right. Well, Gideon Ruckman has at least noted that conversation, and he asked Gutenberg that question. For me, it was just powerful and exciting vindication of what the Trumpet has been drawing attention to for years and years now. You know, you can go back into the Trumpet archives 5, 6, 7 years, and you'll find us dissecting Karl Theodor Zu Gutenberg's his hereditary and talking about him as a potential leader of Germany. So it was just kind of it was exciting to see perhaps the most prominent journalist in Europe write about that in the Financial Times.
Getting into the substance of the interview. You know, what strikes me about this is just how coy Gutenberg is in a lot of ways. I mean, he's very approachable. He's very, very down to earth the way that he talks with this man. And he's very clear-eyed in his assessment of the problems that are besieging Germany right now. He was also quite frank in his criticisms and quite outspoken about his criticism of Angela Merkel. What were some of the in terms of the substance of the interview that struck you?
Well, there was one quote here where Ruckman asked him about the his act of plagiarism and the fallout when that was discovered. And he quotes Zu Gutenberg, and Gutenberg said, "I'd been irrationally hyped, way too high. It was far from reality, at least in my own perceptions." It's talking about how popular he had become as Germany's defense minister. At that time, right before his downfall, right before he was ousted, he was the most popular politician in Germany. But he says, "It was far from reality, at least in my own perceptions. Looking back, that was one of the mistakes I made, that I allowed it, that I didn't actively counter it. But that's extremely difficult when the whole thing is rolling." And there's two or three occasions like this where Zu Gutenberg, he comes across as, he almost sounds repentant. He's rueful, he's humble, he's modest, and he absolutely, he gives the impression of a fallible man.
Right.
And it's just interesting. You know, the reason that we would find this especially interesting is because in that prophecy that you cited earlier, the Daniel 8 and Daniel 11 prophecies that talk about a coming strongman leader in Europe, those prophecies very clearly say that he will come in by flatteries. And that means, you know, he'll be a smooth talker. They also say he will come in peaceably. You know, he'll have a warm personality. He'll have enticing words. And when you read through the lines, or when you consider the tone of this article by Ruckman and the interview, his interview with Gutenberg, you absolutely get the impression of a man who is humble, repentant, modest.
Seems to fit the description.
Fallible. Yeah. It's fascinating.
We also have this article that came out just this week in the Deutsche Zeitung about Gutenberg exercising humility. And this is in the German language. We had it translated by a staff here, but it talks about exactly what you were just saying, how he's looking back on what precipitated his political fall, that the discovery of his plagiarism. And this talks about how he feels like that there were legitimate reasons for his resignation and his careless dealing of it. This article says many now suspect his show of repentance grows from the fault of the overhype in his first career. So he's looking back at this with remorse, and the kind of thing where you could just see people saying, you know, look, we got to give this guy the benefit of the doubt. He's obviously extremely talented. He has a bright political future in front of him. We have to let this go. This article says at the same time, take his words for what they are, a first attempt at comprehensive humility. Previously, self-criticism in Gutenberg meant to stand next to oneself and marvel at one's own mistakes. Now a new level of repentance is reached, an admission of guilt not followed by a defiant but. Like he really does seem to be presenting himself as, you know, real genuine, sincere individual who really wants to put this behind him and move forward.
And maybe he is. I don't know. But there is something endearing about fallibility. Mm-hmm. If you think about it from a human to human level, there's something endearing about the imperfections of another person. I mean, it engenders sympathy. It creates a certain level of contact with his followers and supporters. You know, people can look at Gutenberg and they'll think, well, he's just one of us. You know, he's got his problems and I've got mine. And that's, in some ways, that's how a leader can really connect with people, is when the people see him as being a fallible human being, as being a man with some problems and some flaws, as being a man who is just like them.
Right. And he seems like he really has already demonstrated that knack for connecting with people. Even back to his days as a defense minister, he was loved by the soldiers. He's always seemed to have a pretty strong connection with the people. It was really more of like the press and the elites who came down on him so hard for that plagiarism scandal, if I understand it right. But it seems like he really has retained that connection with the people.
Absolutely. It was the press that pushed him out. I haven't ever quite understood how worked up the press became 5 years ago. Really, I think his banishment to the United States has been a blessing in disguise for Carl Theodor zu Gutenberg. The past 5 years have been a horrible period for any politician in Europe. I don't think you could name a politician in Europe who over the past 5 years has grown in popularity.
Right.
So for Gutenberg to be all by himself, to be making a bucket load of money over there in the United States, serving his time in isolation, it's only benefited his career.
Yeah, so here is this prominent Financial Times reporter sitting over the table at dinner with Gutenberg, and he says, given all the uncertainties in Germany today, he asks, are you getting calls from Germany saying, come on back, things are... He interrupts me before I complete the sentence, and he says, yes, more in the last couple of months. And he's right there to say, yes, there are a lot of people asking for me to get back into the game. Really interesting.
It is interesting, because as smooth and as sincere and as warm as he is, when Carl Theodor zu Gutenberg speaks on the issues and when he writes on the issues, he writes with force and clarity and strength. His insight is always penetrating. He's logical. He's rational. I mean, he's appealing not just from his let's say his personality, and even the personality of his entire family, but he's appealing because his solutions make sense, and he shows himself as a man who understands and really clearly sees the problems that face Europe and face Germany.
A lot of what people seem to be inspired by, or at least attracted to, and saying that he needs to get back in, is his foreign policy experience, his understanding of the international scene, the way that he really presents himself as someone who would be able to handle crises on the scale of what Germany is seeing today.
Right. And he has a, I think if I remember correctly, his PhD may have been in the area of it was a specific study into the Middle East and maybe even, you know, Europe's relations with Iran. He was defense minister of Germany. I think he was economics minister. He's been a member of a number of different panels within the German government. I mean, he knows the world. He knows politics. And beyond that, he has the connections. He's part of the Christian Socialist Union, which is the chief political party in Bavaria. And Bavaria it's the soul of German politics. It's the soul of European politics. So he has connections with Stoiber. He has connections even going back with Franz Joseph Strauss. This man he knows all the important people, or he would have access to all the important people.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Brad McDonald. He's working on an article about Mr. Gutenberg. You can watch for that online at thetrumpet.com. Thanks for your time, Brad.
Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
A new program will start airing on KPCG next Monday, right. March 7th. And this is a program about books. The title of the program is Just the Best Literature. It's going to be presented by a trumpet writer that we've had on this program a number of times, Dennis Leap. Hello, Dennis.
Hello, Joel.
This is a 30-minute program. It's going to air every Monday morning at 8 a.m.
Right after the news.
Yes. I know that you're excited about this program. I'm excited. I had a chance to listen to the first episode. Very engaging program.
Oh, good.
So you have some pretty big, noble goals for this program. What do you hope to achieve with this program?
You know, it's so exciting, but when you start talking about just the best literature, there's scads of it. I mean, we can go in so many directions, but there is some. Let's say we do have a purpose in it, and that the big purpose is we want to get people reading books. And there's been enough studies done that I don't want to pick on Kindle, I don't want to pick on an iPad, because there are times I read on an iPad, and there are times I'm so close, I just want a Kindle, just because I want a Kindle. But anyway, they have done studies, and I've actually done a little bit of off-the-cuff research myself. But people that read books retain half as much more of what they're reading than people that read on Kindle.
Wow.
And the thing is there's a blue light that's emitted from the screen. It's probably more in the iPad, iPhone. I don't know so much. The Kindle is really pretty soft light. That's a little bit different.
Well, the Kindle is they call it like electronic print or something like that, and it
right.
simulates.
It's different.
But it is different than an actual book.
Right, exactly. And the thing is what they've here's the big thing, is that on the first program I talk about a book by his name is David Denby, and he was a film critic for The New Yorker for years. And what does a film critic do? They watch films. And he said he was watching films all the time. And what he found out from himself is he felt that his brain was degenerating. He felt it was like turning to jelly. And now I'm kind of getting ahead. We're going to talk about this more in the third program. So we have three programs on reading. But he felt like his brain went turned to gel. He had a couple of teenage children. he noticed that they didn't like to read so much, and they they wanted their screens. They they were on their iPhones all the time. And so what he actually decided to do is he wanted to do more research on it. Now, he didn't do this big project because he's not necessarily scientific-minded, but he was just really curious about it. He actually went back to school. He went back to 10th grade, and he started studying 10th graders, and he went to three schools in New York, in the New York area, New York City area. And these were all top-notch schools. They're not poor schools, or they're not schools with let's say just your average student. These students had to apply to these schools. They had to pass certain tests. And he said this would be probably so good for him. So he went back into the schools, and he actually went to class with these young people. He read what they read. I think he did the essays that they had to do. He wrote right along with them. And he said that his mental capacity increased.
Wow.
He could tell. This. And so it's really amazing. He's learned it himself. And now he's kind of become like he's out championing the war to make sure that parents, and he does see it as a parental problem, he's making sure that parents really get behind, let's say, what their kids are reading, read with them, get them involved in reading, get them involved in thinking, get them involved in writing. And it's really, really quite exciting.
So you're seeing this radio program is essentially a little battlefront in that war to try to reclaim our attention spans, to reclaim our critical thinking ability, to actually, if we never had it, to gain those things.
Absolutely. And the thing is, it's really, like I said in the first program, I know people are going to like it. They're going to jump in on it. But I said, look, you have the chance to be part of the biggest book club ever, because we know KPCG is heard all over the world. And I said, the benefit to you, it costs you nothing. Mm-hmm. But we're really going to actually have people. We're starting the first book I want people to pick up and read. We're going to read Old Man in the Sea. It's a very famous book. It's an old classic. But a teenager can read it. A young adult can read it. We want older citizens to read it. It has a little bit in there for everybody. And because we're right here on the Herbert W. Armstrong campus, I don't think maybe most of you know me as a trumpet writer, but I also teach English language literature here at the college. I also teach Shakespeare here at the college. And so what we're going to do is we're going to bring these really talented sophomore students in, and they're going to discuss the books with us. So people can grab a cup of coffee, get a friend to come over, and join in the discussion of it all. And so I think it's going to be really helpful. But we're going to read other things. We're going to read some modern nonfiction. We'll be reading some modern fiction as well, but we'll get just the best. I want to do some essays. I want to do some really good, here we are, when we work for the trumpet, we work with the trumpet writers. There's some great articles I think people should be reading. We could, recommend some of those, talk about some of those.
Well, I'd like to, maybe we can get back to more detail about this book club idea that you're talking about. This whole idea of using your brain and trying to exercise it and improve and increase your capacity for thinking, for reading, for really quality thought. I think that's just an outstanding goal to have. I know it's one of the things that we talk about quite a bit as we're in trumpet meetings, and just recognizing the fact that we're always kind of bumping up against this. And just trying to speak to people who don't necessarily read a lot, and trying to grab hold of and hold on to an audience, it's something that I really think is almost like a crisis in modern times, that a deterioration in thought and the deterioration, the ability to read it's really handicapped people from even being able to process some of the concepts that we're trying to get across to them. This really is like exactly what you're trying to target with this program.
It's interesting. David Denby would agree with you 100% on that. And the whole idea behind, it's not just that we want to just sit around and read books and get intellectual and say, well, I read this book or I read that book. But what's really missing in American society now is people don't even know how to sit down and have a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not challenging yourself to think, And, you know, we do want to cover social issues with some of these things. I mean, the old man and the sea, here we have problems with older people in this country. They're getting Alzheimer's, and they're, you know, Mr. Jeremiah Jocks just had that great article in The Trumpet. And, you know, there are statistics that prove that what people in these retirement homes need to be doing is reading, getting them to read a book, getting them to get out and converse and discuss it. And it would really work well to help them to combat Alzheimer's and to combat dementia and some of these other things. You need to have your brain active. And it's really great to sit down. I know one of the things that Denby brings out, especially for teens, he says, look, if you get your teen reading and you read a book with them and then you discuss the book with them, they will begin to identify with the characters. And in other words, a character in a book, if they identify with that character, then you can learn more about your teenager.
Mm-hmm. So actually a shared experience within the family where you're, I'll tell you what, I have a 14-year-old who is a voracious reader. Actually, all my kids read a lot, but it's really difficult to keep on top of making sure that they've got high quality literature and that they're reading good stuff. But to actually be reading everything that they're reading is
a challenge.
More than what I can handle. She actually makes fun of me because she'll put a book in my lap from time to time and say, Dad, you should read this. This is really good. Yeah. I'll hand it back to her a year later and say, yeah, I really like it.
Yeah. Well, I think everything is going to have balance. We are busy people. Of course, you know, you're teaching as well as writing and you're helping with publications. But there is a time when you could probably pick one book and maybe it might take you 3 to 6 months to get through it. But at least have some discussion with her then.
As a means of having something in common to talk about and
right.
to kind of find out what's going on in their mind and to challenge them to, well, what do you think? You know, maybe you right. need to think a little bit deeper. Like you talk about that in that first program, just how difficult it is to challenge a younger person to think beyond just, oh, I found that amusing or
right.
something very surface level.
Right. Now, I don't necessarily agree with every book that Denby might recommend. I mean, there are some, he really gets into like Nathaniel Hawthorne and, oh, even maybe recommend some Poe and things like that. Now, those things are really dark and gothic, but there's plenty of other stuff. I mean, you know, even right now in English 212, that's the Shakespeare class we're going through, the play Hamlet. And the thing about Hamlet that is so still, it still astounds the world is how much everybody identifies with Hamlet. And people say, wow, when I read Hamlet, it's like reading something that I think. And the reason I think that is Shakespeare had such a genius that he understood the human mind and he understood human nature. And he brings these qualities out into play. And like Hamlet wondered, well, who am I? You know, what's life all about? You know, where am I going? What goals should I have? You know, here I am. I'm scheduled to be king and my uncle takes over. You know, these things are people have experienced this throughout the ages. And it is kind of interesting that if you have a student, you know, that comes into your, you know, like your sophomore English class, you know, they have those questions like, who am I? They're trying to figure out who they are and what do they want to do with their lives. And Hamlet just presents it all to them and they can start to think and discuss. And, you know, it's really quite interesting. And even Old Man of the Sea does the same thing. You know, here he was old. He was this great fisherman. He was really supposedly the expert. He gets to be an older man, and he's kind of made fun of by the other people. But here's this young little boy that still believes he's the best fisherman, and he gets out, and then he catches one of the biggest marlin ever.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, spoiler alert. But but anyway, I'll stop there. But still, how many people that are, let's say, retiring at 65 or 62 and they just go off and they, you know, they play golf or maybe something like that. And then they end up dying because, well, what do you have to live for? And so that book really gets into some of those issues. And, yeah, so that's why it's so good, but there's value in there of teaching young people how to respect older people. And there's, you know, this man just goes through these horrible trials to bring this fish in. And it's like, okay, the older you get, it is a little tougher, mm-hmm. but you don't give up.
So you're really talking about finding ways that anybody can identify with right. some of these, say, pillars of Western literature. You have quite a history and extensive education in literature, and but you're not making this program for just for educated people. You're really trying to who is your audience here?
Well, I really want it to be like for every man, or you know, women and every woman, every father, every husband, every child, and it's like there's value to. There is another education, I think, another education level that isn't less necessarily just scholarly. And I think books can bring out, there's practical things in books. There's practical wisdom. You don't have to just be a scholar, but what books can do for you is they can bring an experience in your life and you can learn from it and you don't have to make the same mistakes if you get the right literature. Most writers, when they write something, they write it with a purpose. They've either experienced something they don't want someone else to experience, or you know, there's a little bit of a lesson there. And especially some of your more classic literature, you really can learn from those experiences. Especially when you get into biography and autobiography, you get into some of the history. We certainly want to cover those things. I know I really want to get into the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin with people. I know it's like an older piece of literature. It's back all the way, you know, back to that 18th century. But do you know that book is still the number one bestseller today?
Well, really?
Yes. Huh. It is still on the top of the list. Huh. People still buy that book. And I know a lot of schools use it. But he gives some incredible tips on how to be a moral person and how to work hard and how to have a schedule. And, of course, I think everybody knows. Maybe they don't know. But he had his own book club. He started the Junto. And it was very famous, and there was like 12 young guys got together, and they wrote essays on current topics, and they came in and presented them before each other, and they talked to each other, and they had this conversation, and it was supposedly exclusive, and then they weren't going to expand it beyond the 12, but then those 12 went out, and they started their own juntos, and then those 12 went out, and so it's really, really pretty interesting. He was pretty much ahead of his time.
We're just about out of time, but I got two quick questions to ask you. One is, you were talking about maybe Old Man in the Sea and material that would reach some of the older people, but you had an experience this morning where you were on the other end of the spectrum. Maybe you could just give us a real quick digest of who you're trying to reach with this program.
Okay. So the second program is how to teach infants and young people to read. Mm. And how to get them to really, you know, love reading. The thing is if you get a child that's 16 and 17 and they don't have a love for reading, it is hard to get that started. So parents, the way you combat that is you start with your infant. And so I went to the third and fourth grade this morning here at our Imperial Academy, and I read the student's Yertle the Turtle. Now that's a Dr. Seuss book, and we're going to have a whole program on Dr. Seuss. But it's a great story, and I went in there with the idea. Now, I told them we were going to tape it. They're going to appear on the radio program. But I went in there, and I said, oh, my voice is a little gravelly. Who'd like to read? And they all wanted to read.
Yep.
And they loved it. And what kids love, and little kids, even from infants, they love parents and adults to read to them. And then what the parent needs to do then is to have the child read back to them. And they learn to read, and they learn to love it. It's an emotional experience for them. Mm-hmm. They're in this warm, friendly, family type setting. And so if you do that with an infant, that child will be hooked for reading the rest of his life. And that's just really important.
The last quick question, back to this book club idea. Are you actually going to have, this is the next book that we're going to cover in the next program and notify people in advance? So yes. The idea is that they're actually reading it, and as they're listening to that discussion, not that they couldn't listen if they haven't read it, but if they have, then they're going to get that much more out of it.
That's exactly it. About every three or four weeks, we'll announce another book, and people can buy them most of the books we're going to recommend are very easy to buy. There's the Dover Thrift Edition. They're about $4 or $5. It's not going to be a big expense. But we'll just announce that, hey, you know, in a couple more weeks, you're going to be doing this. Mm-hmm. Get out, buy the book, start reading it, and then we'll let you know when we're going to discuss it. So I think it's going to be good.
Very cool. So we've been talking with Dennis Leap. He's going to be hosting a new program on KPCG called Just the Best Literature. This is a 30-minute program every Monday morning at 8 a.m. starting next Monday. Please do tune in, and thanks for your time.
Thank you.
It's time for today's Last Word.
A while ago, I was talking with someone working a construction job on a large lake in Oklahoma. Next door to his job site is a grandfather who's tried to make his home as inviting as possible for his grandkids. He bought a couple of boats for them to fish and ski with. He has beautiful acreage for them to run around on and play to their heart's content. But the grandfather lamented whenever they visit, his grandchildren just want to sit inside and watch movies or play video games. More and more young people don't even know what to do with themselves outside. I remember spending a lot of my youth outdoors. It happened that my family lived within a short walk or bike ride away from seemingly endless acres of woods in which my sister and I would climb trees, build forts, indulge our imaginations in countless ways. We had miles of roads to bike, fields to explore, sand piles to jump off of. I also grew up a half mile from a beach filled with all kinds of interesting things: clams, crabs, kelp, skipping stones, driftwood, and other surprises that would wash ashore. Today, urbanization has turned yesterday's open woods into housing developments and strip malls. Sending kids out to roam the neighborhood is more dangerous. As a result, it seems that for most young people, the real world has begun to shrink. At the same time, thanks to television, movies, video games, and the internet, the virtual world for young people has dramatically expanded, a noisy, hyper world that requires no imagination and which they can experience while sitting comfortably on their cans. I have to wonder, though, how much of the problem lies in our own laziness as parents. My children and I have enjoyed reading the Little House on the Prairie books by Laura Ingalls Wilder. These books vividly describe the joys, labors, and trials of a homesteading family in the mid-1800s and show that our lives today are, by historical standards, undeniably easy. The result is we're far less capable and far less filled with wonder. Is it possible to reverse the trend? I picked up a couple of books filled with crafts for young people, one for girls and one for boys, written in the 1880s. I am amazed at how intensive and involved these activities are. These books describe how to make knives, how to rear wild birds, how to build boats. The American Boy's Handbook includes these chapter headings: homemade hunting apparatus, etc., practical taxidermy for boys, snowball warfare. The American Girl's Handbook includes instruction on how to make plaster casts, how to reseat a chair, how to paint china, how to transform old furniture into new. A chapter on how to make a hammock reads, "It is not difficult to make a hammock. Anyone can soon knit one that is strong and comfortable, and it should not cost more than 50 cents. The materials required will be one hammock needle about 9 inches long. This can be whittled out of hickory or ash or purchased for 10 cents. Two iron rings, 2.5 inches in diameter, which will cost about 5 cents each. Two mesh sticks or fids, one 20 inches long and 8 inches wide, beveled on both sides, the other 9 inches long and 2.5 inches wide, beveled on the long edge. These you can easily make yourself from any kind of wood." Wow, you get the idea. The children in the 1880s must have been a different breed. An activity book telling girls today how to make a hammock would, I'm sure, begin, "Step one, buy a hammock." Today, we are simply less capable because we're used to having everything handed to us. Frankly, as a 43-year-old man, I would burst with pride if I successfully made the hammock described in this book. And as I proudly invited guests to try it out, I would remain utterly tight-lipped about the fact that I found the instructions in a girl's crafts book. We need to provide our children regular, stimulating challenges, hunt down opportunities to keep them active, to engage their imaginations, to work their hands, to show them what they can do if they only make the effort. It's so much easier to keep a child indoors, to plop them in front of a screen of some kind. In some ways, it's even safer. But I'm convinced that in the long run, it comes at a high cost. I've spent many summers volunteering at church-sponsored youth camps. It always makes me smile to see teens biking, canoeing, shooting arrows, running, and playing outside. Over the years, I've noticed that generally the stamina, physical coordination, and skill level among teens has dipped somewhat. The military has noticed this trend in its new recruits as well. One recruiter said that while their overall physical capabilities have dropped, they do have strong thumbs. Still, at a good summer camp, they push themselves physically, often past what they feel capable of, and have a rigorous outdoor experience. It exposes them to realms of possibility that they probably would never discover on their own, and contributes to happy, shining faces and a visibly healthier outlook on life. Young people have strong, youthful bodies for a reason. We need to encourage them and teach them how to engage themselves vigorously in real-world activity, to do, as Ecclesiastes says, whatever their hand finds to do with their might. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. If you like the analysis you hear, we want to give you a free subscription to the Trumpet Magazine. The voices you hear on this program are the writers of this exceptional monthly news magazine. To receive the Trumpet every month for free, go online to thetrumpet.com. We also have articles posted there daily, reporting and analyzing the events of the day and how they fulfill the prophecies of the Bible. Feel free to send us your thoughts on this program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Brad McDonald, Jeremiah Jacques, and Dennis Leap. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondeau. And I'll leave you with this thought from Dale Carnegie. Inaction breeds doubt and fear. Action breeds confidence and courage. If you want to conquer fear, do not sit home and think about it. Go out and get busy. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. And online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.